Welcome to Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. This is part two of my interview with Russ Baker, author of Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, The Powerful Forces That Put It in the White House, and What Their Influence Means for America. It's March 26th, 2009. Russ, it's nice to have you back.
Thank you very much.
By the way, I should ask you, what was the publication date of the book? When did it officially...
The official pub date was January 6, 2009.
So it's been out for a couple months.
Right.
I just want to leap right in because where we left off, we were, you know, we'd covered some ground, but we... This book is a big book, and for, you know, people who haven't seen it, I know that sometimes people look at big books as daunting. I think this is not a slow read. I mean, this is a book that just, like a good, any good investigative journalist does, you start the story and you go. And the web here is very complex, and there's a lot to say. So I think it's good for us to have a second chance to talk. I really would like to talk about George W. the Younger. He's somebody that everybody who reads the book will have personal experience of, unlike some of the events in the book, which now are history to a lot of people. Talk about George W. in terms of his being groomed for a role in the sort of larger stage. And maybe also, if you can, try to explain why the Bushes are important to this story.
Okay, well, first of all, I think that each succeeding generation of this family, it is inculcated in them that there is a special mission. And how exactly they present this mission, I don't know. But there must be some kind of heart-to-heart talk about why elites need to lead the country, why this is, I guess, purportedly for the good of all of us. Perhaps it's a kind of a Platonic vision. But in any case, clearly all of the Bush sons was made clear to them, just as it was to George H.W. by Prescott, that they've got this role and they need to learn how to keep their mouths shut. And so George W. Bush, you see him from a very young age. His father, who I established in the book pretty clearly, was doing some kind of intelligence work his entire adult life, is taking him on these strange trips all over the world. The father is running this tiny offshore company that has just a few rigs, and yet I've got these records showing his travels, which are astonishing, all over the world. He even opens offices in places like Medellin, Colombia, which is far from the coast. No idea why he would be there. And he's taking young George W. with him on all of these trips, so he's trying to already get him familiar with this. We see George W., his sort of summer jobs, and even while he's in Harvard Business School, his first summer job, while all of his classmates are going off to sort of Wall Street, big corporations, he goes off to Alaska to a very strange company, an airline and pipeline support company. And I interview in Family of Secrets the man who ran the company, who explains that they were doing contract work for the Central Intelligence Agency. So we see that George W. is not just this sort of clod and oaf that we think of him as, but a guy who really knows how some of these things work and knows how to keep his mouth closed.
One of the characters, I can't remember exactly who it was, you have describing him as being, oh, I know, it was the evangelical guy that they brought in to kind of prep George to become something different, because they needed to have the, it was almost like they needed this conversion story in order to make him palatable. But that guy was very interesting. I forget the guy's name. But
Doug Weed.
Weed.
Right.
Who describes Bush as very decisive, very smart, intellectually, I mean, just incredibly different from our kind of public view of him.
That's right, and fascinated with intrigue, fascinated with spycraft, the uses of propaganda, loves all of this stuff. And, I mean, I think in a sense he sort of was having the last laugh. But if we look at his trajectory, Basically, I believe that they sort of manufactured this notion of a rift between father and son. Every profile you read in magazines and books sort of have that the son and the father were very different and so on. And, you know, they were different stylistically, but the truth was the son was always trying to please the father and was sort of always very much involved in, shall we say, the family business. The father was seen as this sort of, you know, even though he had become a Texan, that he was seen as a sort of effete East Coast figure. And the father lost for re-election in 1992. And I believe that the organization was determined that the son would not have these problems. So they spent years draping him in this Texas regalia. And they succeeded. You know, the quote-unquote owner of a popular Texas baseball team, tobacco chewing, wearing cowboy boots. And then they engineered this terrific thing about the religious conversion. And I have an entire chapter in the book where I really, through my research, I was able to establish, I think, that this touted experience of being reborn had some cynical elements in it, that they had calculated that, first of all, because he had never accomplished anything in his life and because he'd been somewhat personally, you'd say, reckless in his social life, that they needed to recast him as somebody with a clean slate. But not only with a clean slate, but that this would appeal to the evangelicals in this country, that they like a reformed sinner better than they like somebody who never needed to be reformed. Right. And so this was this whole...
It's like a myth. It creates a myth.
That's right.
Well, and talk about, I think you spent a lot of time, and maybe for me it was a little too much time, but I still thought, I understood why you did it, on George Bush and the National Guard. And I think this is a really, really important kind of crux. I think you show almost without doubt that he is guilty of desertion, essentially. From the National Guard. But talk about it in the context, I think, most particularly of Dan Rather, that whole story of the, which we now believe to be the truth, that Dan Rather screwed up and the whole news organization screwed up and improperly accused Bush of something that you actually have other evidence for.
That's right. I mean, this was one of the first things I looked at back in 2004. I was fascinated that a man who had so many questions about his own military service in the National Guard was sending National Guardsmen to Iraq. And we interviewed National Guards people, and they basically said they had been given almost no training before being sent off to Iraq, that they were sitting ducks, and a lot of them were injured and killed. Many of them were from Texas, interestingly. And, you know, when you sign up for the National Guard, you don't really expect to be sent to any war, that you think you're going to be piling sandbags or something. So I was intrigued by the apparent hypocrisy here. And what I discovered was that this was really the dirty little secret of the Bush family, one of them, but for George W. was the principal one, was that a family that was always so supportive of wars everywhere and whose political base was very much so-called, you know, pro-military, veterans and so forth, that this family had the secret, which was that their son had skipped out on what was already a safe military service, flying a jet in the Texas Air National Guard. And when I began looking at the Dan Rather thing, and I might say I had some of those same documents around the same time that CBS did, and I looked at them, and they comported with the research I had done, with the research that reporters that I talked to at the New York Times and other places, everybody who had looked into this stuff believed that the evidence was overwhelming that George W. Bush had skipped out on the last 2 years of a six-year obligation. So when these documents came along, we understood why CBS was intrigued by them. In retrospect, I now am leaning toward the notion that those documents were part of a covert operation to basically trap CBS and Dan Rather, who was one of the most outspoken critics of the Bushes over the years, very rare for a national television personality, going all the way back to Iran-Contra and further, and that this was... There were documents that didn't add anything to what we knew. They just sort of confirmed that, and they had little tiny anomalies in there. And of course, the second those documents went on the air, there were these bloggers right away challenging the most obscure things in there. And I talked to people who've been involved in the world of creating fake documents and covert operations, and they said, well, that's a classic. You give something to somebody that they think is real, they go public with it, and blows up in their faces.
Right.
What I think is amazing is that today more people seem to think that Dan Rather did something wrong in relation to Bush's military service than Bush did.
Right.
And that's a brilliant propaganda coup.
Throughout the book, what I continually came up against with this notion of disinformation, misdirection, as brilliant. I mean, essentially practiced and taught by the CIA and other intelligence activists, not information collectors, but the people who are using intelligence organizations to change events, which is, you know, we talk about the CIA and intelligence now. If you think about it, the framework of that is they're gathering information to tell us about threats. We believe that that's what they're doing. They're there to protect us. But historically, what the CIA and other agencies have been about has been proactive, being involved in events, not just being collectors of information. I think you come up with an amazing array of information that makes us realize that it's possible the CIA has been involved in domestic affairs in a direct way for a really long time. So two questions that come of that for me. One is, are you afraid, since so many people involved in opposing or revealing these events or these kinds of stories, are you afraid for yourself in any way, shape, or form? And I guess secondarily, what happens? You know, what happens to this information? How do we act on it? What do we do with it?
Well, let me first of all just say that there are some real dangers to having something like the CIA even existing. Harry Truman did not want there to be a CIA. He thought that formerly intelligence was only really supposed to exist in wartime, and he thought there were real dangers to having something like this. But the man who was the architect of it was a business partner of Brown Brothers Harriman, of Prescott Bush, and these wealthy families wanted this entity. It's dangerous, just like it was dangerous to have a KGB and continue through Vladimir Putin, to have any of these countries run by people who spent their lives in the shadows. I don't think they're great advocates of democracy. I don't think they like the idea that, you know, some scruffy person on the streets of Austin, Texas is going to determine who the next president is and affect their wealth and their ability to operate. I don't think they like any of that, and I think it is deeply troubling. For myself, I don't know if I, you know, should worry about my safety or something. I mean, I think I'm a positive person and try to take care of myself. And I think that you do the best you can, and you hope that you can. There are enough other people who follow up on these things, and you create sort of safety in numbers. Your second question was.
My second question is: well, if we have this knowledge, if we believe that the things in your book are indeed true, what is a citizen to do? What are the things that you can do with information like this that tells you basically there are power interests in the society that have more control over events than we believe, and that as individuals, it kind of disempowers us? How do you take back power?
Well, first of all, let me say that I do strongly believe that knowledge is power. I don't think it's just a cliche. And the fact is that most of the people in this country know so little about how anything operates. The fact that I, a well-informed person, didn't know about any of these things, I think that just simply educating ourselves, studying these things, digging into them, and talking about them already is a way to strengthen democracy. Because the fact is there are more of us than there are of them, and when we are informed about these things, we become vigilant, whether it's about how effective voting machines are, or how effective propaganda and advertising is, the role of money in politics, All of these things are intertwined. And if we know what is going on, we talk about it, we use the internet effectively. And I might say, as regards the book, Family of Secrets, you know, we haven't been able to get even a review in the New York Times, which asked for a copy early on. They just can't deal with this stuff. And, you know, 1,000 footnotes in here, 500, you know, named sources. The stuff is solid. And the citizenry has the power. I see this through the internet. The Family of Secrets is selling very well, and it's because of word of mouth. It's because of the ability of individuals to get out there and use their email lists and chats and all of these things to sort of spread the word and talk and discuss what ought to be done.
Well, I think that's right. I think knowledge is power, and we have to believe that by people becoming aware of the way government works, the way power operates, that we can expose it and embarrass it, essentially. It's almost the way some dictators have fallen. It's the only way that happens, is to expose the truth and bring information out into the open.
That's right. And by the way, I mean, as an adjunct to this, I've started a not-for-profit organization called whowhatwhy.com, whowhatwhy.com, and the idea is very simple, a non-partisan, a non-commercial, non-corporate, a website where I'm hoping to be able to bring in a number of serious trained investigative journalists and tackle some of the largest national and international topics on secrecy, on the causes of war, the backstory on the Wall Street collapse, all of these things. I think there are very deep and profound explanations that have not been unearthed. To do these things, we can't do it, again, without people being involved. So we've set it up with the site where people can go and click and say, I'll give $20 a month to support this kind of thing. And then, you know, just spread the word and get involved, go online and comment on things, get a debate going. But I think these are exciting times, and I think that there's a real chance to rise to a whole other level of understanding. And with that comes a kind of a satisfaction that we're beginning to take the power back.
Well, thank you, Russ. I really appreciate it. This has been really good. The book that we've been talking about is Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, The Powerful Forces That Put It in the White House, and What Their Influence Means for America. I think that last statement is really what's most important right now. The publisher is Bloomsbury, and I'm David Wilk. This is Writer's Cast. Thank you, and thank you, Russ.
Thank you very much.